Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Blastic Plasmacytoid Dendritic Cell Neoplasms. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Naveen Pemaraju from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Pemaraju's slide presentation. To begin, he presented a case of a young woman with classic BPDCN.
This case, Neil, is from 4 years ago when we were just learning about the tegraxifusp experience. And so we thought that all patients were going to be able to get CD123. And this case reminded us that not everyone qualifies. So let me go through this case with you. So this is a 25-year-old woman who presented with abnormal skin lesions. They were described as dark red, dark purple. She had them for about a month to 6 weeks. And it's kind of a typical course that we see. First presented to the PCP, was given antibiotics for a potential MRSA type infection, no response. Came back for a second presentation, was given a steroid pack. Again, some transient disappearance, probably because BPDCN is steroid sensitive, comes back. Third presentation, now the skin lesions are disseminated. They're everywhere. Biopsy is performed finally at this time, if you will. And it showed the markers, and I want to make sure I remind people what those markers are. So CD123, CD4, CD56, these are surface markers. So think 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then the specificity markers, which we've only recently started thinking about, TCL1, TCF4. So she was clearly diagnosed with classic BPDCN. Young female, so it's usually an older male predominant disease historically. So that was kind of the teaching point for us in this case. Bone marrow was done, even though there was no pancytopenia, 1/4 taken over by BPDCN, so 25% blasts. PET scan shows no lymphadenopathy. We did our lumbar puncture. We were starting to realize about CNS back then. Luckily, no disease. So we've got disease in, if you will, 2 out of 4 compartments, ready to give the tag. But up, the chemistry did show that the albumin was quite low. So we want that albumin to be 3.2 for the tag. It's on the package label, just like we did in the clinical trial. But good performance status, young patient, albumin for whatever reason, maybe some malnourishment, maybe because of tumor burden, I'm not sure. So the practice point here is yes, young patients, AYA, female, anyone can get BPDCN. And two, okay, we're not able to give CD123 right now. It's contraindicated, so don't try to give it. You don't want to pump up the albumin to give the drug. It's okay to give albumin once you start the drug. So guess what? We went back to the old school. We went for the hyper-CVAD, but we were understanding that Ven works. And so we gave this patient hyper-CVAD Ven. She did extremely well. I gave her 4 cycles. So I was able to deliver 2 intrathecal per 4 cycles, total of 8. All were negative. And we were able to go to an allotransplant 0-1. This patient's alive and well 4.5 years later.
So one question is, once you get a biopsy, is there ever any issue of misdiagnosis?
Yes, there is. I see that commonly. There are 3 areas of misdiagnosis. One is that it's the case is signed out as AML with leukemia cutis or AML NOS, not otherwise specified. That's a common one. My suspicion, Neil, and I can really say this after I've been really looking at this the last decade and a half, is that there are a lot more cases of BPDCN out there than we think. So the path markers, all this thing. Number two, I do see a couple times a year misdiagnosis of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, even though they're 2 separate groups, because it's something that has skin lesions, Sézary syndrome, mycosis fungoides. You and others have done programs on that. Everyone knows what that entity is, but they're completely different on the microscope, as you know. And then 3, what does trip us up now with the recognition that some entities can have a PDC proliferation, so a mature PDC rather than a blastic one. Those are not BPDCN. Those might be reactive cells. They may be part of the malignant clone or the tumor environment. That can trip people up. So those are diagnoses like CMML, AML, other myeloid malignancies. We don't know what the significance of that PDC clone is, but the WHO recognizes it. So pathologists are appropriately and correctly reporting it. So we need to follow and see, you know, what that is. But yeah, you're right. This is one of those that can be mimicked by or mimic other things, misdiagnosed. Neil, I think the concept is if we don't think about something, we can't diagnose it. So we need to think about these rare diseases.
Interesting. So what's this patient's current situation? Is she doing well?
Yeah, so 4.5 years later, this particular patient is doing well. Some mild GVHD early on that was easily treated, but is alive and well and working and a success story for the clinic.
So you brought up the question of sort of what the cell of origin is here. Can you kind of talk a little bit more about that? Do you visualize this sort of as a leukemia?
Right. Yes to everything you said. The cell of origin first, that's a hot debate even still today in our field. So if you go back 20 years ago when it was called blastic NK cell lymphoma, the thinking was is the majority of these patients have CD56, actually 5 to 7% won't, but 95% or so will. So that's a common NK cell marker, as you know. So it was thought to be an NK cell, but that was wrong. Then it was thought to be a lymphoid derivation. That was wrong. In the end, yeah, I'm comfortable calling this a myeloid leukemia, as you said. Interestingly, the latest WHO puts it under this dendritic cell histiocytic. So it kind of is in the super category, if you will, with Langerhans cell, Rosai Dorfman, Erdheim Chester. But the differentiating thing here is, as you guys know and can see, this thing turns into AML leukemia. So yes, I consider BPDCN as a leukemia. It's an acute leukemia. It's not a chronic disease. The majority of patients will die within 1.5, 2 years of diagnosis, even if they present indolent skin disease only. And I think now the cell of origin is its own thing, right? Now we know it to be not only a dendritic cell, but a PDC, a plasmacytoid dendritic cell. So that's supposed to be contrasted with conventional DC. So it's an immune blood bone marrow cell that is important in our innate immunity, adaptive immunity, and can traffic to the skin and back, which is probably why the skin is involved. And so, yes, I do consider it a PDC leukemia, and it is a leukemia for sure because it can transform to AML in a high rate of cases.
And how often do you see cytopenias?
Cytopenias are common, but not in all patients. So as you're nicely drawing out here, some patients will present, as this one did, with skin-only lesions, for example, or lymph node, and not yet have cytopenias. We don't have a terminology yet in our field of early versus late or stage 1, 2, 3, 4. But let's say a quarter or more of these patients will present upfront with cytopenias, which is usually a bad sign because probably the bone marrow will show extensive involvement of the BPDCN in the bone marrow. So I would say a quarter of the time, usually indicative of bone marrow. Now, we assume everyone has bone marrow involvement even without it, so we check it. But for sure, that's why the bone marrow is important even in these skin-presenting patients.
And you brought up the issue of this lady's lower albumin level and capillary leak as it relates to TAG. Can you just talk a little bit more about capillary leak syndrome, what your vision is for the pathophysiology of it? I'm trying to think of other situations in medicine and oncology where you see it also.
Well, that's great. Yeah, that's worth a discussion because you and I, we've been in the field for a while. This capillary leak is not new. So as you mentioned, if you go back to our training and practice days, capillary leak is present in cytotoxic chemo, peritransplant, multiple myeloma, and other diseases that secrete sort of proteins and other cytokines, systemic mastocytosis, and then other targeted agents. One place where you and I have seen this is the Denleukin Diffitox drug. So that's also a diphtheria toxin conjugate. That's where we've seen it. 1/3 of those patients can have capillary leak. Moxetumomab from the hairy cell leukemia, that's a Pseudomonas toxin. So potentially some link to bacterial toxins. Obviously, targeting CD123 is present on endothelial cells and Kupffer cells. So you're right on the money as always. Capillary leak has been around in our field. Now, number two, you have to differentiate it from disease versus therapy. And then number three, clearly in this new era of targeted therapies, such as the TAG agent, capillary leak syndrome can be deadly, right? It can be life-threatening. So I think three parts to it. One is education. The education part can't be stressed. Any talk I give, as you saw here, I'm presenting our successes, but I'm also hand-in-hand going to talk about the black box warning and the capillary leak. Two is educating the patient, the family, the PharmD, the nurse. Neil, oftentimes in leukemia, the side effects and AEs happen on holidays, nights, and weekends. So some planning with your team, especially in that first dose. Now, that's education of yourself and your team, the family, the caregiver. I usually take a separate half an hour to an hour session just for the capillary leak, as you're asking. Number two is prevention, daily fluid checks, eyes and O's, every hour on these patients, daily weight, watching the creatinine, LFT, any sign or symptom that can tell you that, hey, they're tipping over into this entity, and then holding the drug if it meets certain parameters. For TAG, it's very clear. It's on there. If you have a 1.5 kilogram weight gain in one day, you're holding the drug, if the creatinine, if the LFTs, if the fluid balance. And then finally, the treatment. Unfortunately, people will still tip over despite the awareness and watching out. That's when you're talking about life-saving maneuvers like high-dose steroids, diuresis, albumin. It is sort of a cytokine-based phenomenon, right? So this is not CRS, which our listeners are much more familiar with immunotherapies and CAR T, but this CLS clearly has some kind of a cytokine immune overactivation complex. And so steroids are life-saving here. So I would say, let's say education, prevention, treatment. That's my vision for moving forward with the Caplyolic. I have to say, I find it to be overall very well managed now, 10 years later, now that we know about it. People have access to the internet, information, the teams know about it. It's an FDA-approved drug, so it's on the formulary at a lot of places. But education, prevention, mitigation, treatment, that's my vision.
How often in a typical year, how often do you see a patient who has capillary leak syndrome, and how does it present clinically?
So nowadays, what I'm mostly seeing is the more minor version. So let's call it grade one or grade two in our research, or in the common context, mild. This 18 to 20% is about a good number. So about a fifth of the cases usually tracks with people who have a lower albumin, or the albumin is really tanking. So the kinetics of the albumin. But what I normally see, because we're watching for it so closely, is the first harbinger is usually a tachycardia, can be also fever and some shortness of breath. Patient will need 2 to 3 liters of oxygen. Usually in the clinical practice, Neil, I have to say, you in real time, often you don't know what's going on. So antibiotics, if you think there's sepsis going on, diuresis, albumin, oxygen support. And then if it's really getting fast quickly, I have a low threshold to give the high dose steroids, whatever your hospital has available. But with this, watching out for it, early treating, usually it's abrogated there with a few doses of steroids, few doses of diuresis and albumin. Every once in a while, really not often anymore, a patient has to go to the ICU. Their early pressors, early oxygen support steroids can quickly reverse. Most of these patients come out of the ICU in 24 to 48 hours, and then you keep moving. But I would say most of the time, it's these early signs and symptoms that probably in the beginning we weren't aware of, and now we're hyper aware of.
You know, another thing I was wondering about is, have just straightforward antibodies to CD123 been tested?
Yeah, good question. We have done some of those, and some of those are in the literature. There have been other CD123 agents tested, not as great efficacy as what you're seeing here with the TAG and the IMGN programs. That's a great question, and we've seen that in other fields in oncology, now that you mention it, where sometimes the naked antibody or the antibody by itself may have modest results. But then when it's conjugated or combined with something else, better result. That's actually a great question and something that needs further evaluation. But the answer is, yeah, these are not necessarily the first CD123 drugs, but they've definitely been the best so far for BPDCN specifically.
I mean, trastuzumab, pertuzumab would be some examples. And, of course, they have ADCs there too as well. You also was fascinated that you're getting to look at CAR T. What about bispecifics?
Bispecifics are out there. We have several in the CD123 space. They have been, Neil, primarily and almost exclusively tested so far in AML, and some of those results have been published. The concept here is, can we move those over into BPDCN, either including it in those trials or having our own separate? So stay tuned for that. I do have interest in investigating those further, but so far no data to show.
All right, let's go to your next case. The 72-year-old man.
So, Neil, this is another important case I wanted to share with you and the team, which is a 72-year-old man who comes in, again, with this purplish, discolored sort of maculopapular rash. No major plaques, but definitely has that look. But this patient is different than the previous young patient. This patient is having systemic symptoms, fatigue, a persistent anemia despite transfusions at the local office, and circulating blasts. So it looks sort of like an older AML case with AML leukemia cutis versus our BPDCN. Skin biopsy shows the classic findings for BPDCN, so ruling out the AML leukemia acutis. Bone marrow, unfortunately, shows a high degree of blast, 72%, with the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 that we've been talking about. So no doubt, clearly BPDCN, extensive disease at presentation. We did our molecular panel. We have an 81-gene panel here, but whatever panel people have, it did show the TET2 mutation, cytogenetics, diploid, and actually pretty good performance status despite this fatigue syndrome. No major past medical history or surgical history, so fairly healthy 72-year-old man before this current extensive disease profile. Importantly, and obviously you know why I'm listing this here, the patient had a normal echo, EF of 57%. He's a room air, no COPD, decent cardiopulmonary reserve, and a normal albumin. And so the question for us is, how would you treat this patient in the frontline setting, age 72, with fairly preserved lab parameters? You know, we talked about the historical with the multi-agent chemo. We talked about the new agent, the TAG, with this black box warning of the capillary leak. Patient and family were very interested to go for the TAG agent. And so we commenced, you know, with the Tagraxofus, the TAG agent. Patient was able to take that in very well. After two cycles, achieved a CR confirmed by cycle four. Went on to receive ultimately six cycles. And what's amazing in this patient, 72 years old, easily went for an allogeneic stem cell transplant, is doing well 2 years later in a remission. And so the case for us presents two, I would say, fundamental practice points. You know, number one is that the TAG agent from our New England Journal and then the subsequent JCO paper, we went up into the age mid-80s for this drug. So we treated young patients, older patients, no hair falling out, no neutropenic fever. There were no hospitalizations except to administer the drug. Patient. And then the other concept is that patients well into their 70s, we're now routinely doing allo transplant, either with a reduced intensity profile or even a full myeloablative. So this one I'm pretty proud to show that with the targeted agent, we were able to get to a nice outcome.
Did you do a lumbar puncture or treat this patient with intrathecal treatment?
Yeah, thank you for reminding me of that. Yeah, so this one, we also were able to do lumbar punctures, even though we didn't publish doing those before with the TAG because we weren't looking for this. We are now doing two intrathecal chemos, even with TAG, just like we do with chemo. I usually do IT ARA-C first, alternate with IT methotrexate, two for the first four cycles. So this patient, yep, also did receive eight total LPs, all negative.
There's a lot of debate about whether CNS prophylaxis is worth doing in, you know, more common lymphomas like diffuse large B cell. I hear people are questioning whether they even should do it or not. How about here? Do you think it's efficacious?
I'm glad you brought that up. I've been following that debate and discussion very closely. Here, it's been efficacious for sure. I would put 3 points in our BPDCN field. One is the incidence is far higher than we thought. It's probably 20 to 30%. So for sure, we've got the numbers. Two, when you detect it early, as you know, then you can move to more frequent LPs and or radiation, whatever you need to do to eradicate it. And then three, we found that in these monotherapy treated patients who looked like they were cured and they were doing well, were frequently starting to relapse as CNS positive diseases. And so that is something more, Neil, I would say on the order of Burkitt's leukemia lymphoma, maybe, or these long-term high-risk ALL patients. So for us, it's a really straightforward answer in terms of that. It's really changed our practice for the better and allowed us to early go for treatment of CNS disease if we find it early.
About how long ago was this man treated?
This one is 2.5 years ago.
And if this man were to present today and, you know, putting reimbursement and access to drugs, if you could access anything, how would you treat him?
Ooh, that's good. I would say I've got a couple of nice programs right now. Number one, I would say a CD123 targeted therapy for sure. We're able to get a deep, clean response with that in the standard of care setting. And so that's either the IMGN632 on clinical trial or the TAG standard of care. The number two approach would be clinical trial, I would say, too. I should highlight that I have these triplet clinical trials ready to go for patients. You have to be able to travel. You have to be able to do that. But that's the TAG Ven AZA clinical trial or the TAG HyperCVAD Ven. But for standard of care, I have no problem offering CD123 for this patient now. and then clinical trial. If relapse, then we have, you know, obviously HMA ven available. We have chemo ven, all these other strategies.
Any preference if you had the choice between TAG and pivekimab?
That's a good question. Hopefully we'll have that choice soon. So, you know, to note for our listeners, as we said earlier, the pivekimab is still in clinical trial, not yet FDA approved, but a positive phase two data, as I showed. I think the drugs have two different profiles. In this patient with no cardiopulmonary issues, normal EF, normal albumin, we were okay to give the TAG, but a lot of our patients will have those issues. And so, as you mentioned, the pivekimab, we saw zero capillary leak syndrome, really well tolerated, except for, you know, some of the patients having low grade peripheral edema and some thrombocytopenia. So you make a good point that it'll be nice to have both of those options. I think, Neil, what'll happen, because there's no biomarker to guide, that they're both CD123 active drugs, I think it'll be the patient comorbidity profile that will probably help to decide there. But I would say either of those drugs are fantastic for our patients.
What kind of profile would get you to prefer TAG?
Well, that's a good question. I think we now know that the capillary leak syndrome is managed and manageable. But I think the concept is that we have longer term follow-up with the TAG. So now with the JCO paper, we have this 3-year follow-up. So a good, pretty good handle on the safety profile and all that. Whereas the pivekimab, a little bit earlier of a drug. So usually that dictates, I think, practice patterns in the clinic. But I do want to emphasize, as you're nicely drawing out here, both great options. Really, it offers CD123. Oh, and also another point that you're reminding me, the CD123 is retained in these patients even at the time of relapse. So let's contrast that, as you and I know, and say ALL, you give a CD19 agent like Blina, you can lose it and then not, right? So here it's almost always retained. And so for the first time, we've shown sequential therapy, TAG, and then relapse, and then give the IMG and pivekimab and have a response. So I think that's something we may see as well, that really both drugs will end up be given in the journey of the patient.
Any data to support efficacy differences? I understand there's more follow-up with the TAG, but at this point, you know, indirectly comparing, does efficacy seem similar to pivekimab?
I'm very pleased to see it. You saw the numbers there in the frontline setting where the focus will be. Really respectable, both of them. Really happy to see that. And also I'm proud of the way we enrolled, meaning older patients, you know, respecting and reflecting the real world outcomes. So I think when you look at the patient characteristics, the response rates, really happy with both of them. So as you're asking, they're just really two great drugs. Just have to know the side effect profile, watch out for the comorbidities, but really happy with both of them.
You talked about the triplet approaches, you know, maybe for younger patients. Can you talk a little bit more about the types of triplets that are being studied right now? You know, what we've seen and, you know, is this what you'd want to see one of your relatives on?
That's awesome. Yeah. So as much success as we've had with these monotherapies, and of course, we know that's the first step, especially for drug approval, drug development and safety understanding. You know, we are starting to see patients relapse after any therapy, whether it's chemo or monotherapy CD123. And so, yes, I am very excited for the near future, even now, to start investigating these triplets. We take our cues from AML usually. So my colleague, Dr. Neville Dover, who you in the program know, are already pioneering this triplet, actually the pivekimab. So the IMGN pivekimab, ven-aza and AML, showing very positive results there. And so as we're seeing here in BPDCN, we've already started to do the TAG ven-aza triplet. I'd like us to see do these other triplets. And then for the younger fit patients, go with the chemo. My thoughts are twofold. One is I want to aim for cure of the disease before it has a chance to have MRD positivity, CNS relapse. And number two, I want to aim to try to eliminate stem cell transplant, which is not available in the vast majority of patients all over the world. So because we are seeing relapses, some of which are early after monotherapy, that's the impetus to go for triplet therapy in BPDCN. Two, we already know AML and myeloma are doing it. And three, we have three or four classes of active drugs. We just have to figure out how to combine them in a safe way to improve the efficacy.
Any trials are considering the issue of maintenance after transplant?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. We do have one active trial in that space, which is the TAG for post-transplant maintenance. Still don't have a field yet there. I think we need to do two things first. One is we need to develop a standard MRD assay for BPDCN. Right now, we're borrowing from whatever is available, ALL, AML type basis. So as you can imagine, looking at flow cytometry, residual disease that way. And then two, we still don't have a good idea of understanding who's going to relapse post-transplant and who isn't. So obviously looking at baseline characteristics and all these things that some of the other disease types have done. I'll also add that we still don't understand what skin MRD is, right? So you can have complete clearance of the skin, visual clearance of these lesions. It's very obvious to anyone who sees it, but then microscopically how to define it. And then, as you say, we need to see then who would benefit from which drugs. You could see the CD123s being an obvious nice choice, especially because maybe they have activity at the level of the hematopoietic stem cell. Number two, HMA-VEN, for example, which is already being tested in AML as a post-transplant or post-chemo maintenance. And then the oral AZA, which is already US FDA approved as an oral maintenance strategy in AML without transplant. So I think you're right. I think this is another next steps for the next 3 to 5 years that we're working on. And also I'll add in there, is there a concept for going for second transplant? Yes, we have sent patients to second transplant with some variable levels of success there. So stay tuned for that. But MRD assessment in the blood, bone marrow, lymph nodes, skin, how to define that in BPDCN?
I was going to ask you before, these skin lesions, are they typically pruritic?
Ah, great question. Not always. So the majority of these BPDCN lesions are not itchy. They're not pruritic to patients. So I would describe them as painless, non-pruritic, dark purple-colored lesions that if left alone can develop into larger sort of wart-like structures and even plaques, but usually not itchy or painful.
All right, let's hear about your 66-year-old patient.
Sure, Neil. My next final case here is a 66-year-old patient who comes into the clinic with a known diagnosis of BPDCN and, again, looking for frontline options. This patient is notable for having, this patient has a low albumin and some comorbidities, extensive skin lesions. So in this case, we discussed the standard options, chemotherapy, TAG, but the albumin was rate limiting here anyway. And so we offered clinical trial with the IMGN632 pivekimab sunarin, which we've discussed here. Remarkable response in this patient. This, I'm showing you the picture after 3 cycles of therapy on protocol, complete resolution of the skin lesions, just leaving the shadows of them behind. We did objectively do it with this MSWAT score, as you know, which was quite massive at the beginning, 88.5 down to 0. And then even the bone marrow also responding from 62% to 5% blast negative for BPDCN. This 66-year-old patient with some comorbidities was able to achieve a nice CR response and was ultimately bridged to an allotransplant and is alive and well less than 1 year later.
And how did he tolerate the treatment?
Yeah, the treatment went extremely well. So really no major toxicities in this patient. I think as we mentioned here, but it's worth reiterating here, there's no capillary leak syndrome with this agent, but approximately 45% or so of patients will have peripheral edema, usually after subsequent cycles. And about a quarter of the patients will have either thrombocytopenia and or an infusion-related reaction. But this patient did very well, tolerated very well, and was able to get this as an outpatient.
Interesting. Anything you want to add to what you said today, particularly maybe your vision for the future with this disease, where you see things heading over the next 3 to 5 years?
Wow, Neil, thank you so much. In fact, doing programs like this with you helps us to think about the field, right? Because it makes us have to reflect on where we are, where we've been, and where we're going. Neil, I think there's 3 major questions that I'll leave you with for our field, and this sort of gets me really excited to think about that. So number one is the next area will be thinking about pediatric and young patients with BPDCN. Really, if you look in the literature today in PubMed, it's a scattered series of case reports, some cases of even spontaneous remission, you know, some things that happen in pediatric populations that we don't see in adult. My beginning investigation with our pediatric colleagues is showing that it's a completely different disease. Molecular findings are different. the young patients won't have CHIP, as much UV light exposure. So understanding the differences with pediatric versus adult, I think, is going to be huge. And so I call on all my pediatric colleagues to assist in that effort. Number two, Neil, I think it's going to be going for curative therapies that do not require stem cell transplant. You nicely drew all that out here. I think the vision and the future is already happening, which is triplet, maybe even quadruplet chemotherapies or combination therapies up front, and really trying to eradicate disease before it comes back, including in the central nervous system, skin, brain, blood, lymph nodes everywhere. So really want to see that field develop. And then number three, clearly, is we need new targets. We need our basic and translational scientists to work with us to identify new targets, which will then open up brand new areas of investigation outside of CD123, BCL2, some of these obvious things that we've already gone for. And I personally am looking forward to that, because then we will be able to get our hands on new drugs, combinations moving forward.
The other question is, you know, you listed a bunch of other cancers that overexpress CD123. Do you see any of them actually ending up being treated by one of these agents?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. For the future of the broader field, this sort of CD123 field, which I'm actively involved in, yes, I do. I think what's interesting is that in these other myeloid diseases, myelofibrosis, I didn't mention here, but we did conduct a phase 2 trial, CMML. So we've done monotherapy trials. We're in discussion to see about combination and trials in these areas. Yeah, I think so. I think it's interesting. Hairy cell leukemia almost 100% of the time expresses CD123. Lymphomas maybe 20% of the time. Systemic mastocytosis close to 100% of the time. So I think it'll be very interesting. I think we have to think about toxicity of these agents, particularly in the more chronic CD123 expressing diseases, where maybe oral drugs are the ones that people are used to, and hospitalization, capillary leak, you know, might be difficult. And then number two, smart combinations in each of these drugs, JAK inhibitor, hypomethylator in the respective. But I like your question. Yeah, I don't just see this as a BPDCN field. I think CD123 will find a home eventually in multiple other areas that are CD123 dependent or driven fields.
You would think or hope that pretty much every patient with this disease would at least have some connection to an investigator like you. Is that actually happening, or do you see people actually trying to treat this disease without input from a tertiary center?
You're right on in everything you said. There is a sort of a running kind of nice compliment joke in the field that this should be called Pemorrhage's disease, right? In other words, we do believe that probably 90% of the cases in the country go through me and my team in some way, whether it's an email, a phone call, or a follow-up. I will say that it's kind of like you do want to see your kids graduate and go to college eventually one day. So I am proud that we got the drug FDA approved several years ago. I'm proud to know, and I can tell you for sure, that all parts of the country, people are prescribing the drug, thinking about BPDCN, enrolling on the IMG in clinical trials. So that's gratifying too. But you're right, I would like to be a part of that, at least for the first years of this field, because the toxicities, the rarity of the disease, the research that we can do. And so that's why we formed this NABC, this North American BPDCN Consortium, to try to really capture 100% of these patients and learn everything we can for the next 100 patients.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Pemorrhage, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.